You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I want to say a special thanks to the people who came from out of town, including one of our panelists, Robin and Joan, and as well, even De La Fruz as well. So I also want to note that Joan's going to contextualize why this book exists and why we're here a little bit. But just to say that there are chapter authors up here and there are chapter authors out there, including Zoe Brogdon standing in the back there, who also is one of the chapter authors, as well as being the primary mover and shaker of this event. So if you're going to shake someone's hand, make sure it's Zoe's. Federico and Yolande, also authors. And I don't see Mirka. Oh, she is. Sorry, Mirka. That's me not with my glasses on. Yeah, I already said. So thank you, other authors, for also joining us and helping to sort of push this conversation along. I think otherwise, originally I was going to try to capture the range of other representation here, but it kind of seems like most of you maybe have some idea of that already. But just to note that we are grateful for other foundations joining us, we are grateful for other general higher education expertise joining us, and we're grateful for anybody, frankly, who finds this interesting and is somewhat involved in this, what we're trying to take a look at here. But then I will turn it over to Joan and then come back for the heart of it.
Thank you very much, Martha, and I'd like to start off by thanking Martha and Zoe and the Open Society Foundations for hosting us in this lovely space, and for all of you for coming. This is beginning to feel as if we really do have a community of research and practice around scholarships. Those of us who have worked in this field know this, but it's nice to see familiar faces and also new people who are joining this conversation. Martha asked me to help contextualize the book. Why did we do this? Clearly, it was a labor of love, and we like to be with our friends. That was one reason. But more seriously, the idea for the book, as we recount in the introductory chapter, came up when we had a little side meeting at a NAFSA convention in 2015 in Boston, now my home city. And it occurred to us that we'd been having these kinds of side meetings with other scholarship practitioners at the margins of international and higher education meetings for many, many years. But there was no book, a solid piece of work that we could point to that began to bring together the knowledge, research, information, continuing questions that we had about the art and practice of international scholarships. And so rather than having a newsletter or continuing to promise to be in touch and then apologize for why we weren't at the next meeting, we decided that we would actually build a book. And I think what was most important about this is it's a conversation. This book is a conversation about international education and international topics, but it's conducted across national lines. It's conducted by international people. So it wasn't just a few views. It was a multi-perspective view of what, in fact, is a multifaceted problem. So the first reason for working on this book and trying to create as much of a holistic view of this field is precisely because it is very fragmented. We looked into many studies, found out that at least one inventory chronicled scholarship programs in 200 countries. There was no systematic categorization, very difficult to even get your hands around what we mean when we're talking about scholarships. And if you couldn't do that, it would be very difficult to have a field where you could go beyond just trading tips and actually do serious research. So our first impulse, and this is clearly just the beginning, not the end, there are other books out there, of course, was to try to address this question of a fragmented landscape. And we did that in the organization of the book by having a number of cross-cutting themes that always resurface: individual versus institutional support, and particularly the focus on the relationship of scholarships to social change. That was our big driving force. So the data are still very incomplete. The field is very dispersed, but our first motivation was to bring together as much as we could to start creating, delineating the borders of a field. So that was motivation number one. Motivation number two that I think is very important and still ongoing is the reemergence of higher education on the development agenda. For years, the orthodoxy promulgated by the World Bank and many development organizations was that the major investment had to be in primary education. And while that wasn't a bad thing, it also coincided, particularly in the 1980s, with a major disinvestment in higher education. So you saw the collapse of many, for example, flagship public universities in Africa. So as a result, over the last 10 to 15 years, maybe even 20 years now, there's more attention paid to higher education as a means to spur international development, investment in human capital. And since scholarships are a very important part of why individuals are able to attain the kind of mobility they need to access higher education, that gave the whole framework more urgency than had been true in previous years. And the final reason is that I suppose you could refer to a boomlet, a little boom in research and evaluation studies in particular. We have Mirka and Rajika here from IIE. The Institute, of course, has spent many years doing evaluation research and trying to build methodologies that actually not only measure impact, but begin to assess it in a more substantive way. So those were factors. The landscape was fragmented. We wanted to at least try to bring some coherence. There's more emphasis now on higher education as instrumental to development, and there has been in the last 10 to 15 years more research than had been done previously. And so those were the factors that led us to say, well, now it's a timely moment to try to pull this together as much as we can, and not only try to summarize the state of the art, but to lay out what a future agenda of both research and practice would look like.
Fabulous. And well-timed. Others take note. So we set this up to be kind of an interview situation. I have specific questions for each of my colleagues up here, and we'll sort of go through each one. And the colleague at the very end, it represents a specific perspective because she's one of our alum from one of our scholarship programs. So she is here to definitively tell us, you know, what we've done right or wrong. But I'm going to start, and I'll just do some what I hope will be tantalizing descriptions of the chapters that we represent. But I'm not going to do a full description of each one and then ask the questions. And I'm starting off with my friend here, Robin Marsh. And Robin, if you don't know her already, is Robin is a socioeconomist with over 25 years of development practice and research experience. And she's currently, luckily for her, I think, a senior researcher at the Institute for the Study of Societal Issues at Berkeley. And as well, one of the co-editors of this volume, as well as a co-author of the chapter we're about to discuss with Dr. Ruth Waifo Oyelere from Morehouse College, who is unfortunately not with us here. The chapter that they did was called Global Migration of Talent, Drain, Gain, and Transnational Impacts. And a lot of what the chapter is digging into is, I think, what is fairly extensive research and data that is trying to track, I suppose, the what we could call the professional migratory patterns of international scholarship recipients. And I think what came out to me, and among other things, was that the data that's out there does challenge, if not, or sort of augment traditional assumptions about what return means. What is the incentivizing, what are the best ways to incentivize scholarship recipients to return to their home country and provide a sort of professional benefit, a profit benefit back to the home country? And so there's this sense that previously everyone talks about brain drain, because if you're in a country that has predominantly centralized financed higher education and you've made an investment in these individuals and they leave and they don't come back, then you've had a loss. So what struck me is that when you start to talk about terms that I think are still getting a little bit of further sort of interrogation within our new field here, brain gain, brain circulation. First thing that comes to mind, of course, is brain circulation, that it kind of reminds us that technology has to be part of our conversation. And the idea that that knowledge transfer can happen almost instantaneously now, and that really does have to be in your brain if you're thinking about then why do we do international scholarship programs if you can hit a few buttons, theoretically, I would say, right? I want to just flag a couple of your stats because I do think it's helpful to contextualize this entire conversation, because it was good for me to learn anyway that international students represent only 2% of tertiary enrollment globally. Most tertiary education is happening locally. Of those who travel in that 2%, most are self-financed. So when we're talking about sponsored scholarships, we're talking about a very specific subset, which Joan reminded me is nevertheless a very strategic investment in those. But I think that any interrogation of the issue of return and impact needs to recognize that we are dealing with kind of a small sample in some ways. My questions, however, so you mention that sponsored study abroad, so scholarships, tends to have better return rates than self-finance. And I just want to know why. Why might that be so? Where does that come from?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm from California, so this seems like a cold day, but it's probably just sort of a medium for you guys. Yes, and that data comes not only from the literature review that we did for this book, but from my original research on African alumni from different North American universities that I did, sponsored by the MasterCard Foundation Scholars Program. It's quite striking that the return rates for international scholarship recipients of those that are sponsored either by government or by private foundations are much higher than those that are self-financed. Self-financed either by their families, which is typical, or even if the universities are chipping in for part of to pay their fees, those rates of return are much lower. And I think it's somewhat self-evident, but I guess it's worth going over the various reasons. The first is conditionality, that those that come on government scholarships or even private foundations, there is often, if not a requirement and a conditionality that they return, and the visa reflects that, if not a requirement in expectation, because often they are interested in the multiplier effects that this young person will return with skills and knowledge and ways of thinking and doing that will spread beyond themselves. And so there has to be return for that to happen. I mean, that's so these students come with the idea that they're going to return, very different than when they're privately financed and it's up to them. You know, that there's They have free range as to what they do when they graduate, and so they're looking almost exclusively at maybe the economic returns or other factors. And a couple other things, and this is more recently, but some of the scholarship programs work on making a softer reintegration or reentry when they finish by providing certain incentives, post-graduation incentives, like small grants or involvement in alumni networks. They may, even while they're studying, sponsor internships back home so that they are developing networks and expertise, meaning that a job is more likely to be waiting for them when they... So they're investing in the scholar to be prepared to move back home, as well as the expectations and conditionality. And the only other thing that I would say that even furthers this is if the home conditions are somewhat positive for the return. So if the home conditions are economically and politically somewhat stable, somewhat dynamic, then all of these, you know, conditions converge. If the situation back home is negative, economically or politically, strikingly negative, there may be people that break those conditionality bonds and don't return. But overall, the data is striking difference between the two groups, yeah.
That is a relief, because we do a lot of program work in designing those enhancements and incentives to return. And it's nice to know that there is data out there that makes it justifiable. So the data and the reports that you've described in the chapter really seem pretty robust in terms of supporting the notion of brain circulation. Mm-hmm. As opposed to brain drain. Nevertheless, you give a couple little tantalizing other things that make me, you talk about Collier's work that suggests that there are also social and political impacts from foreign-trained nationals and households with migrants. You as well bring forward two really interesting examples of when you're talking about incentives to return from programs in Mexico and Colombia, that remind us, again, that there's also the question of intellectual return. So these references to social, political impact and to intellectual return, what I want to know is, do those examples, do they also engage with brain circulation? Because brain circulation is, from what I was reading in your chapter, is a lot about talent and expertise. And that can sort of flow along different international patterns. But sort of intellectual engagement back into home country universities and political and social impact that might change what that household does. I think you referenced voting patterns, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen along those, you know, technology-facilitated communication patterns. So does talent circulation include or suggest a values circulation, in your view, that might lead to what we could start to quantify as positive social change?
Mm-hmm. That was a long question. I'm going to take bits and pieces of it. She cites, you know, Collier's did a great job with his book Exodus, which I recommend for any of you who haven't read it, and looks at all the patterns of migration and the winners and losers in that. And there were a couple of studies that showed, even among the diaspora populations that don't return home, they can be influential in the political viewpoints, even the voting patterns and the social activism back home, because of this constant communication now between diaspora communities and their family. So in, I think it was in three countries, Cape Verde, Senegal, and Mexico. Mm-hmm. There aren't a whole lot of studies that show this, yeah, but they did show that, say, Mexicans in the United States are influencing the way their family votes in Mexico. Senegalese are influencing the way they're literally having conversations over the phone and trying to transmit values and new ideas and perspectives that maybe they're getting from other sources of media that people don't even. I would say that's happening. I wouldn't say that's very huge. I think the main issue that you're pointing to is that brain circulation in the entrepreneurial field, and even in some scientific and technology realms, can work very well because you can have joint ventures, you can have knowledge networks, you can have collaborative research, and you know, where you have labs maybe in two different countries, but they really are communicating well, and you have scientists that work virtually very effectively and entrepreneurs back home in the sending country that benefit greatly from the expat communities or the diaspora communities that are sending them new ideas and investment capital and so on and so forth. These things work well, and that's brain circulation, and we wouldn't want to stop that or curtail that. I think what you're pointing to is the kind of brain drain, which is truly a drain. It's a loss for the sending countries when their more innovative citizens leave permanently, and where the home country is lacking that human capital is for building institutions for the kind of long-term investment in institutional change that you've got to be there. You've got to be going through those passes. You've got to be going, you've got to be gaining a certain reputation, a certain stature that then leads to leadership. And you can't really, we know that people have been in the United States for a very long time or Europe, and then, you know, they return home now to be leaders in their country. It may or may not work because they haven't, as they said, you know, paid their dues. So that kind of, some of the social and political work that we all need the long-term commitment for, I would say, requires physical return, and there is a real brain drain. This is not an obsolete term. And the countries that are facing this most are smaller countries that don't have the dynamism to attract returnees in the same way that in India or Singapore or China would, or Chile or Colombia and Mexico and Brazil, all of which have really good return programs, you know, return incentive programs. So the countries in some sense that we're most worried about are experiencing brain drain. Did that get at some of it?
You may.
Right. So, you know, I think Robin's chapter is very important because the brain drain debate rages on among the economists, and they get very caught up in rather arcane debates about whether the net value of remittances is actually greater than the forfeited income on taxes if people were to return and so forth. That's what the literature focuses on. But the implications of this work for scholarships really drive at the heart, because so many of the designs and the practical decisions about scholarships focus not on the scholarship itself, but on the post-study return. And I think the value of the chapter is to make us rethink the automatic assumption that physical return is what we mean by return. And perhaps the more Catholic with a small c way to think of this is that there are multiple returns on this kind of investment, and the trajectories may diverge. And that's a very radical shift in the way in which the traditional arc of a scholarship is envisioned. And it comes right down to what kinds of requirements and conditionalities are put on the individual. So this is very important to be thinking about this whole question of return in the broader context of global labor markets, for example.
Okay. In a way, that's a good segue into talking perhaps a little bit more specifically about Africa, which is so frequently sort of painted as a diaspora, you know, deep diaspora country. So we're very lucky that Amini Kajunju, sorry, is here to join 5 years ago. Forbes magazine named Amini as one of the 20 young power women in Africa. And she has certainly, I'm not going to arm wrestle with her, but I think that her CV alone far outweighs mine, I think. But I think she's really proved them right in that sort of tapping your potentials and what you were going to do. You currently are directing the strategic partnerships at Africa Integras. Is that still? Okay. That part is, I knew African American Institute was done, but that it's.
Yeah, there we go. I'm now the executive director of the IUGB Foundation, International University of Grand Bassam, which is 30 minutes outside of Côte d'Ivoire, outside of Abidjan in Côte d'Ivoire.
Excellent. And still, I hope, so I just get some of this correct, contributing to the University of South Africa,
I'm on the advisory board.
The advisory board and World Economic Forum, Economics of Innovation Council, and the nonprofit Angel Africa. I want to list them as much as possible so that we get the full range of what we can then expect from you in our answers, right? So your chapter was International Scholarships in the Ecosystem of Higher Education in Africa. And I think Amini took an interesting sort of different tack than some of the other chapters because she went out and interviewed people. She did three solid interviews with some pretty powerful individuals and good thinkers, obviously. Paul Zaleza, mm-hmm. Vice Chancellor of the United States International University Africa. Tade Akinaina, mm-hmm. Executive Director of the Partnership for African Social and Governance Research. And Patrick Awuha, mm-hmm. of course, is the founder and president of Ashesi University in Ghana. Yeah. And I wanted one thing that I wanted to flag at the outset of talking about Africa is that for me anyway, what used to be, oh, well, that's an Africa problem, is no longer the case. Mm-hmm. So much of the challenges that are coming out in that context are true in so many places. I mean, it goes without saying, obviously, the demographics, you know, youth bulge of the population, the lack of capacity of local institutions of higher education to absorb that, the just sort of massive demand on higher education, the sort of lackadaisical attitude of governments in a lot of countries towards putting a priority on higher education. This is all coming forward in various ways from the interviews that you shared, but it's just struck me as reading is that this is, you know, we could be saying this about the Middle East, we could be talking about Southeast Asia, and it's just kind of, I wanted to raise that so that we understand that when you give us solutions that they can be applied perhaps beyond Africa as well. But the thing that I really jumped on in your chapter was that you just briefly reference that in describing the African history of supported scholarships, you mentioned that it started well before international aid agencies and donors showed up with community-led and funded support to students. And I also have an OSF colleague here who sort of echoed this and said that the history of social change in Africa is a history marked by associational or group-led initiatives. And I really want to know a lot more about that because it links into what we're going to talk about with Joan. But so that's the first question is simply, can you give us a little bit more on that particular history of associational impacts on social change?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. That's something that Tade, who was formerly at Carnegie, really emphasized with me. He wanted to share with me and therefore share with the readers of the chapters that when African countries started becoming independent, there was such a hunger for nation building. And then that led to understanding that part of nation building is capacity building, in, you know, human capacity building. And so, you know, despite the fact that now when people think of African countries, we do think of a disinvestment in higher education. But there was a time when investing in higher education was a strong priority. And it happened at all levels. It started at the community level. It went on to, you know, the government sphere. Governments spent a lot of money on higher education, on education in general, but on higher education. There was an understanding that this was going to be a critical element to building the economic and political infrastructure of many African countries. At the community level, there was this, and it still happens today, but I think it was even deeper then. You know, you identified people in the community who you thought could really take off, and then you invested a lot of money and time and effort into them. And the idea was that they would go off and get that education and come back and change the community that they were from. And those models were there. By the time the Americans, you know, came in, whether through government or through foundations like Ford and Rockefeller, et cetera, it was already there. Yeah. And Tade was really, really wanted to emphasize that. And also, before the Americans, there were other countries that were part of this. So, for example, my father benefited from a scholarship from the country of Japan. Japan came to Kinshasa. I'm originally from the DRC, and went to then Lovanyom University, now the University of Kinshasa, and looked for the best students and provided them with a scholarship. My father happened to be one of them, and he was given a scholarship to study at Osaka University. And you know, the condition to come back was very clear. So we went to Japan, we came back, and, you know, my father came back into society and gave back to, you know, the society that he grew up in. But other countries were a part of it. And you can also remember that during the Cold War, the Russians were a big part of this as well. Yeah. And, you know, there's a Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow. So all of that kind of tells you that even before the Americans were sort of a big part of this, there were countries, there were communities, local, and obviously the governments also were very involved in higher education.
I'm glad this is being recorded because I didn't write that all down, but I do want to remember it. So secondly, you also flagged that it's important to give possibly to the benefits of giving scholarship support to African institutions to give out themselves, and that strengthens the institution, obviously, as well as the scholarship's beneficiaries. But you do highlight the key problem or possible challenge here, and I'll quote it because I think this is also true around the world, that the key to attracting more scholarship funds for students is a university's commitment to academic excellence. And what I want to know from what you know is, do you see divergent expectations of what academic excellence is within the continent or internationally? And if so, what should non-African donors and program designers in particular understand in order to keep international scholarship programs responsive to African needs?
We could talk about that all day. I think the influx of resources into African universities for scholarships is a critical conversation. And a couple of things. So one, many African universities may not be aware, or even if they're aware, they may not know how best to attract foreign money in a way that is sustainable and in a way that is that is beneficial to the students and beneficial to the institutions. And you know, donors, so I feel like African universities, like American universities have a really good knowledge of how to deal with donors. And it's been built over decades and decades and decades of American universities being such powerhouses when it comes to fundraising. It's not the case in other parts of the world. It's a very American thing to do. And I think if African universities want to have a part of that, of those resources, we have to, you know, speak the language of the donors. We have to understand what makes us stand out. One of the things that Patrick, that I mentioned in the book, that Patrick from Ashesi University talks about is, you know, many African universities want to be all things to all students. And he's thinking about, could we start thinking about specializing, universities specializing in certain topics and certain subjects, and it becomes a center of excellence for a key set of degrees. And then other universities, you know, take on other subjects because they have competitive advantage in those subjects for one reason or another. And that could be a way to attract dollars, but also to increase academic excellence, because you're not trying to be all things to all people, and you can really specialize in certain subjects and really be good at them and offer them in a 21st century way. But of course, that's easier said than done. I mean, I think of University of Ghana, for example. It's trying to educate 38,000 students. Kenyatta University is trying to educate about 72,000 students. So, I mean, the need to democratize higher education is so great. And at the same time, we need academic excellence in order to attract dollars, real dollars. So that tug of war is complicated to solve, but it needs to be solved. Because a lot of the public institutions don't have enough resources to provide the kind of education that they want to provide to their students. And the academic excellence conversation becomes very difficult to have because these schools are saying, well, we're doing the best that we can with the money that we have, but yet they're not, in some ways, really preparing their students for a 21st century world. It's a complicated conversation.
It reminds me that one of our other alum who also sits on our advisory board has talked to me about donor distortion. And I guess part of the question here, or part of the hope, is that the centers of excellence as they develop in Africa aren't defining themselves by donor terms, right? And
all of us who've managed nonprofits and have fundraised, you know, the challenge is, you know, do you chase the money? Do you say to a donor, oh, that's what you give money to? Guess what? That's what I'm doing now. You know? Or, oh, you like cats? You know, we love cats too. You know, or do you say, you know, this is who we are. This is who we've this is what we've determined to be the need, and this is how we believe we can provide a solution to this need. And then you go out and look for like-minded donors. It's hard. You know, it's really hard. And many African universities are looking to the United States and its philanthropic world and seeing if they can take a piece of it. And I think that's important. I think it's very important. Obviously, you know, where I am at IUGB, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring all that is great about the United States and its resources to IUGB. And so it's a very important part of our work. But I think we need a two-pronged solutions. We need solutions from the United States. Great, that's fine. But we also need local solutions. And I'll just say this, you know, one thing, and we can talk about it even some more. But, you know, how does philanthropy look like in Africa? We are philanthropic people, but we typically do it through families and communities. We don't do it through institutions. It's not very often that a wealthy African is going to write a check to an institution that he or she cares about. Do we need to change that because our needs are so great on the education front, on the social front? Do we need to have the Dangotes of the world write a check to an institution, an educational institution that they care about, so that they can see a certain kind of education happening? Maybe, because we can't rely only on American philanthropists, and we can't rely on governments all the time. And so what about the private sector? What role do they play in this?
That is exactly what I wanted to know. So Robin wanted to jump in for 2 seconds.
Just 2 seconds. Just to point out that Patrick Awua, who was one of the three who were interviewed, that Amini interviewed for her chapter, is someone who is an international scholarship recipient and went to Swarthmore and then he went to UC Berkeley, and he decided that the best way to apply everything that he had learned in the United States was to start the small, which now is a very, very successful private university in Ghana. So that's another way in which it's not donor-driven, but some of that American knowledge and influence and networking, which you were talking about, why Patrick is so successful fundraising, it comes through their alumni who were international scholars. So it's pertinent for our discussion here. Just want to point that out. And also a UC Berkeley alum.
And if I'm not mistaken, he had at least 10 years at Microsoft, with Austin, which also helps. And he's a brilliant guy, which really helps. So, Joan, I think we're now going to bring other people into a conversation that you and I have a lot. Right? So, but let me, again, for those of you, and it's unlikely, who don't know Joan Dassin, she is currently a professor of international education and development, as well as director of the Sustainable International Development Program at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis, where we are very, very happy to have probably 600,000 of our grantees go through there, maybe slightly less.
More.
Yeah, right. No. But also importantly for this conversation, she spent at least 13 years leading the Ford Foundation's International Fellowship Program. And as well important for this conversation is that you have 3 Fulbright Awards under your belt. So I feel like you represent not only the teaching research of a university, the program design administrator, but also the scholarship recipient perspective. I'm only going to ask about a couple of these. So Joan did a great chapter with David Navarrete, who's a research professor at the Center for Research and Advanced Studies in Social Anthropology in Mexico. And their chapter was on International Scholarships and Social Change, Elements for a New Approach. And I think this is really going to be something that I hope that continues in conversations after the panel, because the chapter really captures essential strengths and weaknesses of a range of evaluation methods that are already out there that we all see by various agencies over the past decade or so. Recurring message in my reading of this chapter is that there's a problem that we, like, mea culpa, of relying on self-reporting by scholarship beneficiaries. And I'd never really thought about that, because our knee-jerk reaction is, you want to know something, do a survey. But this self-reporting dependence kind of bypasses any other indicators that might be out there, positive social change, that are extrinsic to any one individual's experience. So we all kind of suffer from the absence of control groups. Mirka, you're nodding. and the concomitant difficulties in establishing causality, whether an individual scholarship really does produce what we think it does. As they put it so well in the chapter, if social justice products are simply counted and not contextualized, then what is it that we're really learning about whether or not social change has happened? So the proposal, therefore, is to shift the assessment viewpoint, which I think is fantastic. In their words, it's deconstructing the global vision of social impact and developing evaluation strategies based on a view of scholarship holders as social rather than individual actors. Hence the importance of what Amini was telling us, I think, about the community-led support and the history of social change in Africa. This is, for those of you who haven't thoroughly committed this book to memory yet, this also is reflected a little bit in, I guess, what are more traditional sociological constructs that Matt Maurer talks about in his chapter, and those are micro, meso, and macro approach to evaluation. So what I want to know is, what would this look like? Where would you start? Is there a theory of change out there that would be helpful? Or is this, again, kind of exciting, the beginning of a new framework? That's the first question.
Okay, great. Thank you, Martha. And I want to invite Mirka to have a word about this also, because her chapter in the book is very much about what is the appropriate perspective. How do you begin to even conceptualize this problem, much less solve it? So what's the problem? And, you know, I've struggled with this for probably decades. I don't have a clear answer yet. The central paradox of scholarships and measuring their social impacts is that you give a scholarship to an individual, and yet you are looking for some kind of social change which implies either an institution, other individuals, a community, something larger than the individual. So that's a paradox. We focus all our efforts in scholarship programs on individuals. And increasingly, we recognize the power of networks. So there's a lot of funding for networking events. The electronic communications and platforms make this a lot easier. But we have to be able to get from here to there, you know, get from the individual recipient to some broader impact. So for my co-author David and I, this was the central problem of the book, which is called International Scholarships in Higher Education, Pathways to Social Change. So our first problem was we had to link these two. How do you get from the individual to the social change, whatever that might be? So conceptually, that was really the first breakthrough, and Robin should get a lot of credit for this, and our other co-editor as well. We conceptualized a number of different pathways. That's a metaphor, but it works, to help you to traverse this distance between the individual recipient, me when I was a Fulbright scholar, and the change, positive, we hope, that this individual will catalyze, will incentivize, will help create, right? So some of the pathways that come out are this individual change agent, and that turns out to be the kind of where most of the evaluations end. Okay, you know, Senor X will get his scholarship, study in the fount of knowledge in a Western university, go home, and you know, become the minister of finance, at which point he will no longer support scholarships, right? But he will become the Minister of Finance and therefore make change. So, but however, we were also able to conceptualize other pathways, the networking pathway, and what our Ford scholarship program focused on so heavily, which was using the program itself as an instrument of social change to widen access to higher education. And in a way, that was easier to measure because we could look at the impact, we could look at what the program was actually accomplishing by providing scholarships to people from marginalized communities, others who were excluded from higher education, and so on. So that was the first conceptual problem that we tried to solve, was how do you get from here to there? How do you try to resolve this paradox of an individual investment creating social returns, okay? And just a few more comments about that. What we did in terms of the research in the chapter, which turned out to be very interesting, was we called it deconstructing a global vision, because there's this kind of stylized narrative, the finance minister narrative. You see this in tracer studies over and over and over again. The successful students who usually appear in a little cameo where they tell their story, nobody ever says, let me tell you about the ways I failed. Let me tell you about the 2 years that I spent on the job market. You know, we highlight success. But interestingly enough, that narrative, that trajectory, is repeated not only at the global level, but at the regional level. So David looked into evaluations of CONACYT, the big Mexican scholarship program, which has been going for decades, and a large program from Chile, and he found the same exact narrative. Focusing on the individual, the individual's achievements, the individual's ultimate high position, usually in government, and that was the end of the story. So we said, well, the very first thing you have to do is try to get past this stylization and recognize that all these different individuals are going to have different journeys, and that those journeys are going to have different points of insertion in institutions and so on. And so what that tells us then is that and this is kind of international development 101, context is everything. So there was one other, so we don't contextualize these studies enough, and that's because they often rely on surveys, which can only get at the qualitative, quantitative dimension, and are even then are reduced to a very small number of respondents usually. So not enough people are doing field research, and I have to say the IIE study, a tracking study, is doing field research. And that's really important. So there's one more story I want to tell you that helped us to be thinking about how we were going to deconstruct this stylized narrative. So David in the chapter takes the story of two IFP fellows, both from indigenous communities, with similar socioeconomic profiles. They both, one studied in, somewhere in, they both studied in Latin America, very similar, slightly different fields, but concerned with social justice. And if you were just writing that story from 30,000 feet, you would say, you would look at the successful outcomes. But it turned out that poor Saul had a very different outcome than his successful colleague Alberto, who did very well. One student prospered in the post-scholarship life, the other failed. And so that led us to believe that, you know, you really had to drill down to see what kinds of impacts people were having. And what that ultimately meant, and I'll conclude with this, is our proposal is to change the narrative from an individual story to a collective story, to be thinking about individuals represent groups. They're women, they're indigenous people, they live in rural areas. And to look at their scholarship trajectory not only in terms of where they land at the end, but where have they come from? And what is that trajectory about? And that is a very different perspective than you typically find in this literature. And I would just say one final comment, which is we noticed also when we were doing the research, there are very few people from so-called sending countries that do this research. I was, we have very few scholars from developing countries who are actually looking at what is going on in their own countries. And that seems like something that we can fix by making sure that there are more global scholars that are part of this conversation.
Since you anticipated my second question, the benefits of showing up at 3 p.m. this afternoon, you don't get a second question then. my eye is also somewhat on the clock here, and I want to jump now down the table to Dilla Fruz. Dilla Fruz Nazarova is her website says, an accomplished human rights lawyer, so behave, everyone, from Tajikistan, who's currently working on a doctorate at the political science department at Rutgers. In addition to doing that and being that, she's also the director of development for the UN and Global Policy Studies MA program and teaches international law, civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights. She's done some time working for the Tajik government, but also places like the International Committee for Red Cross, Penal Reform International, Rule of Law Initiative of American Bar Association, and the British Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Most importantly, she is an OSF scholarship alumna. She was a beneficiary of our doctoral fellowship program, which sadly no longer exists, but nevertheless, while it did, it was managed and cared for by Zoe Brogdon, again, back there. So, Dilla Fruz, you have to lay it out. Be blunt, be honest, be real, and tell us, what did we get right? What did we miss?
Hello, everyone. It's an honor to be here, but at the same time, it's a big task to represent a huge pool of scholars, fellows, and alumni. But I'll try my best. So the PhD program doesn't exist anymore, but I do exist. Let's see. I love the book, and I said it to authors before we came here that I don't get to read this kind of literature very often. All I read is about political science and with my children about K-pop now, so they we are into that. And this was a very interesting read. And when I also, you know, went through a couple of chapters, I was also thinking that, I know a lot of this, but I never really thought about those things until I hear or I read that someone else actually vocalize it. And it was very interesting. You know, it's number one thought I had from this book. And there were a lot of good themes, obviously, that I can relate to. But to me, number one thing probably was a part where you discuss what is next. And yeah, that's a big question. And perhaps that's a big question for me, especially now as I'm you know, at that stage. So I'm here in America now, but tomorrow I probably go home and, you know, have to face the reality. Because when we have a scholarship, we are kind of protected, we are taken care of, and we live in a dream for a couple of months, for 2 years when we do our master's, or for 6 years when we do our PhD. But once that is over, we have to be thrown back to reality, which is very often is quite uncertain. Not for everybody, though, but, you know, for many of us, it's quite uncertain. And when I think about, you know, what is next for me, I know that if I travel back home tomorrow, the next day I'll find a job, definitely. So I won't sit doing nothing and wondering what is next there. But would that be a job that, you know, I know that I'm prepared for, or I was hoping to get? So that is a really big question. And how to... So what are the issues there and why it is so difficult even to think about it? Is there are several things, I think. Is for one thing is what you call in the book labor integration problem. So when we return and when we have to prove again ourselves there. So we had to prove ourselves here that we can handle that PhD program in political science that I never thought I'll do. But now we have to go back and again prove ourselves to our government that we are worth offering a, you know, good job there with the perspectives, or you know, non-governmental sector that we possess an expertise and knowledge that you can use there, and to people as well, you know, because it's not only about labor integration, it's also about cultural reintegration back home. So, and one of the issues that I thought that might help with that a little bit is if, you know, those providing scholarships work a little bit harder, maybe, of course, not, this doesn't apply to everybody, you know, all scholarships, but to some, work a little bit better with the governments on the issue of how our foreign degree will translate into the national degree. So would it be accepted there or not? Can we continue our research there or not? And would whatever we came up with, all those ideas and findings and outcomes, will be accepted there and used there? Because a lot of us, we do our research having in mind our countries. And my research is focused on my region and my country, definitely. And I had no other even, you know, any other thought about that. So I always wanted to do that because that's the context I know more. And that's the context I'm interested in most. And another thing is what you mentioned also was about physical return. And I absolutely understand the idea behind that. And I agree that it's very important. But again, a lot of us, because of this problem of labor integration, etc. So sometimes we feel that we can be more useful, you know, working from far away from our country. So as a desk officers covering our region, as people who are promoting information about our country. And so I thought it's important. Physical return is very important, but taking into account that we can serve the same purposes from a distance is also something that that matters. And another thing I was very pleased to read in the book about is that a lot of scholarships, they don't abandon their fellows or scholars after everything is done. And Soros at OSF, proving that I'm here. Yeah. So that's the testament to that. And so that is very important for not only our reintegration back, but also for, giving us some other opportunities. If we cannot find something back home on our own, we still know that there is a support that can be provided. And when I returned back home after I received my master's degree from the UK, and I basically got the same level job I had before my master's degree, so it didn't really make any difference. And after a while, I said, okay, I'm quitting that and I'm doing something else. Let me see what to do. And I applied to OSF office there with a small grant, and I received that grant, and I did a project which I was very proud of, and it was useful, it was interesting, and I worked with the government, so it was impactful as well. So I got everything I wanted to get, so I was very happy about it. It also was a way for me to get access to certain resources or certain people or avenues that I didn't have access to before. So it was that's a great way, I think, to continue supporting alumni, even if not through providing money, but at least through opening those doors or keeping those doors open at least, so we can continue, and we have that time to reintegrate back into our societies. Those were the main points I wanted to make about the book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And noted on the point of alumni grants back in the home country. It's not easy. We've tried it, and part of the problem is simply our own vulnerabilities as staff being based in New York. How do you assess and process grants? But now, knowing that you're here, perhaps we would help have you do it, at least for some parts of the world. I'm very curious, and I want to ask you and then probably throw it out for general mulling over and consumption, is this, we just toss around a lot of words, right? Phrases that there's a lot of assumed understanding here. And one thing that I felt after rereading some of these over and over again, how are we defining positive social change? And I want to know, because now you've sat here in Rutgers in New Jersey, in the United States, which is in a moment of a certain kind, but you have a really strong, obviously, deep understanding of what it's like to be in Tajikistan and what probably other parts of Central Asia as well. What do you see similar elements of how social change happens in both of those contexts, or is it really completely different?
I think there are, people live here and there. So, and there are still, same ways how you can impact people and their behavior and try to change them or, encourage them to be more proactive, starting from, their own personal experiences and, going forward to the communities and bigger things. So I think with regard to social change, the approach is more or less similar in both contexts. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of, how I, for example, as a recipient or as an individual, possibly contributing to positive social change there and here to a certain extent is there are a few ways. And for one thing is, and I faced it so many times, is that for one thing we're raising profiles of our countries, at least definitely in the context of the former Soviet Union republics where I come from. And so that's, and it works both ways. So it works both in Tajikistan. People are proud of me and my achievements there. So, and people are proud here, you know, in my university or in my neighborhood when they know that I'm in academia. I come from that country and I have, you know, all those experiences and I can talk about different things, about American politics and international politics. And another thing is a lot of programs and scholarships are aimed at bringing up leaders. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us do succeed in that role here or back home. And but what I also was thinking is that even if we don't do, even if we are not offered a position at the ministry of whatever, or don't become parliamentarians, so a lot of us serve as informal leaders in our communities, you know, those who are not necessarily visible, but those who are respected and those who are, approached all the time. And it's interesting. So let me tell you my story, what I call my Kardashian moment. 2 years ago in March, one of the prominent media outlets in Tajikistan published an article about me, and the title was something, a Tajik girl now teaches in American university, she's a professor at American university, something like that. And it was a very well-known media outlet, and they published it in print and in the media. So when I woke up in the morning, I had 200 Facebook invites, friendship invites, etc. So that was my moment at the time. And I received so many messages and emails and calls from people who were so proud about, you know, of me and of my achievements. And but the most important was that they were proud that I represent my country elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And this is how people in America see Tajiks, and especially Tajik women. So it was very important for many people. I didn't thought about that before. So 2 years later, so a couple of weeks ago, I went to a wedding with my husband, and it was a Tajik wedding, about 70 people. And when we were driving there, I knew I know nobody there. 70 people invited, and I was sure that none of them are familiar, but it appeared that everybody read that article and saw my picture and remembered me, and they were approaching me, and again with the same things that, oh, we're so proud. I want my daughter to be like you. And so what would you advise? Or what do we do? Which university we go? Or, you know, all sorts of, you know, those kind of issues. So I was an authority there. So they forgot about bride and groom. So I was a professor there. So it was very interesting experience, which made me think that people are listening to us and people look up to us, and it matters for them. And of course, after that, I wrote countless letters of recommendations and mm-hmm. read applications and mm-hmm. Those kind of things. But it's something that I really enjoy doing, and I know that I know the stuff now, and I can contribute to that. Another thing, what the scholarships give us through our training and through our experience abroad especially, is that we are taught to see opportunities, you know, somewhere where others don't see them. And we are more creative, we are more innovative, we are more open-minded, and we are more active, I think. And I noticed it, especially when I go back home, and if I'm involved in any project, be it a bigger or smaller, and when I come up with the idea, first reaction is, are you kidding us? But then, you know, it takes a little bit convincing, but still, you know, people accept our ideas, and they see that we're able to think out of the box very often. Another two more points I wanted to mention is that, as it was written in the book, at least, you know, in the region of the former Soviet Union, a lot of scholarship was, you know, started when after the collapse of the Soviet Union and early or late 90s and early to you know, in the beginning of this millennium. Which is true, and guess what? All those people grew up now and have children, which means that, you know, that investment that was, you know, inputted in us is actually, you know, multi-generational, because, you know, all our children grew up with the same ideas, with a similar experience as my children were with me back in the UK. They're here with me as well, and they experience exactly the same, you know, have the same experience as I have. So those scholarships is not only invested in me, but in several other people, at least in my family. And the final point I wanted to make is that because of my research, I looked at some literature about impact of financial aid and donors, et cetera, et cetera. And donors are usually, you know, criticized a lot for, you know, investing money in certain projects and don't necessarily taking into account local context and not generating that sense of ownership, you know, at different levels. So usually, if it's a rule of law project, for example, international organizations work with the government, with the courts, et cetera, et cetera. But then what happens is the public itself is not really educated and it's not supporting all those reforms because it doesn't understand those reforms, right? And there is, instead of, you know, appreciating them and starting using them, they reject, they start resist all those reforms. So I think educational scholarships address that gap very well by investing in a, you know, broad range of people. So if before it was about elites, right, the first scholarship started there. So now it is more diverse group of people that are covered by internships, thus, you know, preparing public for different changes, be it political or social or cultural or economic. And I think that's where the, you know, a right place for educational scholarship as a donors to, you know, to try to foster that positive social change.
Wow. Thank you. That really ends us on a good note, and at the same time flags what we also don't capture, obviously, in evaluation, is exactly the sort of more intangibles that come from being part of a family as well as part of a community and what you represent. And thank you very much for keeping us cognizant of that. I am as well cognizant of the time and the fact that we only have, I think, the space more or less till 7, if I'm not correct. So I would like to propose, I would like to give you an option, basically. We can stay here and have questions come up to the microphone, which helps for the recording process, or we can mill about and ask questions amongst ourselves,
Or alternatively, I feel it's probably a good idea to give everyone on the panel not only a round of applause, but as well an opportunity for any last statements. But they would have to be super fast. Okay. So all right. Getting good advice from up here. So how about a couple of questions? And of course, be aware that no one's offended if you stand up and go get a glass of wine. Bring two. And and otherwise, but let's open it up. Does anything spring to mind? Anybody else have different interpretations of positive social change? Susan Beresford, you probably do.
Hi, my name is Tenzin Gelek. I work for Trace Foundation, and I've been working on a scholarship since 1997. And a lot of things what you've written and the comments really comes down to what exactly most of us have been faced for the scholarship. And so thank you so much. And especially when you think about the social and the political impact, it really brings me to home, we try to really kind of demonstrate what we did, what we really impacted. And this question has been also mentioned by Susan. As a organization, you have to come up with these figures, say how much you benefited. And so the comments that you bring is really, really very important and useful for me. So I wanted to say thank you. And I just have one comment rather than question. One of the impact that I felt, by many the scholarship organizations, as well as us, is creating scholarship programs around the world. Because I've been talking to a number of organizations who did scholarship, and through their conversation and through our own experience, those people who receive scholarship either go back and talk about scholarship, somebody else pick up the idea and found a scholarship program, or the schools, when they're, for example, one of our fellows, when returned, hired by the university, and he talked about the scholarship that he received from us. The university created a scholarship. So, well, that's a great idea. Why don't we do that? And another fellow who went back instead of a scholarship for Tibetan lawyers, because he received a legal scholarship from us and is still running. And likewise, so there's many impact. And if you listen, any scholarship program officers or the organizations, as you mentioned, they have a connection with the scholarship program. So I'm wondering, in the future, I think when we maybe revise this edition, if there's area of promoting scholarship, everyone seems to promoting something, like a small gadget or the apps, like the smartphone apps, they really spend a lot of time promoting this. But scholarship programs are such important, and can we have a promotion of scholarship as a program overall? So through that, I think the impact may be much bigger. So thank you so much.
I'm sure no one in this room will dissent from that. Pat, I'm going to go back to Kate because I know she's about to walk out the door. But Kate, can you come up? Don't mind. Kate Stimson.
Well, Martha, you've been wicked.
I know. I'm vicious.
The wicked Martha. The very wicked Martha gave us the choice of asking questions or letting you all go have a drink. So please forgive me because I have a question or a comment, and it's the Viktor Orban effect. I mean, I love scholarships. I'm an enormous believer in international scholarships. I was a very happy Fulbright scholar. It transformed my life, as did working with you, Martha. But the Viktor Orban effect, and in the United States we have what I'm calling the Tom Cotton effect, who one of the most conservative members of the U.S. Senate, with presidential ambitions, who was a Rhodes Scholar. And so when I hear us talk about positive social change, I wonder if perhaps we're not dealing in the kind of self-congratulations in which I am a notable expert? Or do we have to temper our rhetoric about positive social change? We have wonderful examples, at least according to my criteria, But haunting me now is Viktor Orban and Tom Cotton. And I know there are others. So shall I continue with my naive optimism? Or do we have to have a more measured set of understandings about what happens and what it's meant by positive social impact? Sorry about the drink, Martha. Should I bring you one?
So I was hoping no one was going to talk about Viktor Orban. But let's, I'll interpret that point just very briefly as an expression of the importance of diversity in any scholarship program. And you have to bring forward people. There is no causality. And B, I wasn't working for OSF when he got the award. But C, that's how long ago it was, frankly. But C, you have to assume that if you're investing in individuals, there will be a wide range of results one way or the other. And we could name quite a few other lousy people that went through scholarship programs, unfortunately. But I think your real point here is that we should not be patting ourselves on the back about positive social change without expressing that there is a counterfactual that will probably happen, right?
Or many different
interpretations. Understood. Pat, I think you were next to walk up front. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Something about what Susan Beresford said on Pat Rosenfield and a former recipient of a foundation fellowship, the Rockefeller Foundation postdoctoral fellowship, and I ran the Carnegie Scholars Program for many years, where Martha and I struggled with other people about what do we do about evaluation. And I want to say that Catherine's Kate's comment is a very important one, but I'd like to go back to the question of evaluation. What Susan Beresford indicated with a short time frame, which is a really, really serious problem as I've looked at fellowship programs today. And one of the things that the Ford Foundation has done historically, but especially with the International Fellowship Program, is shown the importance of a long time frame, not only for the program itself, but the 10-year evaluation that they are funding through IIE. And I think one of the exciting features of this book is giving more prominence to that. So I hope that not only this is widely listened to on this meeting is widely listened to on the OSF website, but that there is a dissemination. This is my nice comment because I have another comment, but has a dissemination plan and that includes the importance of a long time frame. But I was struck by the comments about community and positive social change, and also now that I'm doing more history of fellowship programs, looking at another model that maybe is something we have to talk about. And I haven't read all of the book yet, but I would love to hear if you've looked at what several of the foundations had tried and other international organizations, and that is looking at the context of combining institutional support with individual support. And I know that there have been programs that have worked with university departments to develop staff development plans so there are homes for people to go back to so they don't feel like foreigners. I think the comments made today are extremely important. But I haven't seen so much of this. I'm thinking of Amini's point about the community. And I'd like to know about the feasibility of this, where instead of working with universities, one thinks of an international higher education program, but working with community development organizations, NGOs, and building up their capacity, not only at the leadership level, but throughout the board. And I'm struck by this with the evaluation of the really remarkable IFP fellows who've gone home, many to work in community organizations, but those organizations don't have the depth. So it's not just the leader, but the depth of capacity so that you have the strong institutions that are the community-based institutions. So that is where maybe the next development has to go for local philanthropies, international foundations, and international development programs, agencies.
Yes, please.
This is just one thing to follow up on the time frame that Susan mentioned, and then you reiterated that we have the IFP, which you might think is unique, their 10-year time frame, but it's also true that the MasterCard Foundation Scholars Program is following an IFP's footsteps, and they are going to have even longer than 10 years, I think, in kind of an indefinite learning evaluation of their alumni. which are, there are thousands of them. So we should be looking and learning from their experience. That's just one thing.
Our long time frame at OSF means that we have a lot of data and no analysis, but but your point is very well taken on the other opportunities for combined support. We actually do have some history with that here with the Academic Fellows Program that we did, as well as what Zoe is currently doing in terms of having our graduating grantees take up internships at NGOs and other organizations that have received organizational grants from OSF. So there's some of the beginnings, tiny, of that idea. I'm gonna say yes, and Joe, you better be very quick when you go, but please come forward.
Thank you, Martha. Rajika Bhandari from IIE. And two sort of quick observations. One was the point that was made right at the beginning, that while it's true that when we look at the proportion of scholarships, it might be just the 1-2% of outbound mobility. However, I'd like to argue that the investments made in those scholarships are so substantial and so disproportionately large compared to where else those investments could be made, especially in developing countries and their higher education sectors, which is why so much thought needs to be put into the design and intent of those scholarships. So that was just an observation. The second thing I wanted to mention is that the discussions that we're having and all of the work that you all and others in this room have done towards this book is so critical, and we can begin to see the payoff in some ways. And Joan, this goes back to your remarks about scholarships as a vehicle for development, that it's really terrific now that in the new Sustainable Development Goals, within Target 4, we have within Goal 4 on education, there is actually a specific target, Target 4.B, which specifically focuses on the provision of scholarships for students at the post-secondary level from the developing world, and scholarships provided by developed countries. So I think that's we all should keep an eye on that target. We've been doing a lot of work with the UNESCO Global Education Monitoring Report that's measuring progress towards those targets. And one of the conversations we keep having with them is that they need to move beyond looking just at what governments are doing, but really focusing on all of the private foundation scholarships, which is really, at the heart of what we're talking about here and everybody gathered in this room. So really great book, and I think really valuable conversations. Thank you.
Thank you, Rajika. Joe, please. Yeah, it's Joe Glicksberg from Scholarships here at OSF.
I just have a point rather than a question, but it's something that several of the things that people have brought up have made me start thinking about linkages. And it seems to me that one of the most important things you've been talking about in the book is that there are these paradoxes in scholarships, and that there's this problem with how do we evaluate. And it gets back to the time frame issue that was raised, and also issues about, for instance, do you fund individuals? Do you also fund individuals and institutions at the same time? And something you said made me think about, you mentioned in Africa that there's some of these debates going on about, you know, where universities are trying to be all things for all people, and therefore resources are getting dispersed in a way that doesn't help anyone. Whereas potentially, if you had models where there were regional centers of excellence or something developed in one place or another. And I find this very interesting. I'd like to talk to you more about what's going on in Africa, because I've been following the debate that in the Palestinian territories that's centered around the same question, where there's the Palestinian territories. It's interesting. There's a university in the center called Berzeit University, which is between the north and the south. And there's been a president at Berzeit who's been very active, who's been saying, why do we have 4, 5, 6 universities in the West Bank? We all know Berzeit is the best, he says. So let's just get all the resources and pull it up and come on, let's go. And then, but there's other people who are saying, no, wait a minute, you know, we want to have diversity. That could lead to really bad places, having one university in a country as small as this. And we want regional centers of excellence. So there's another university, An-Najah, has said, yeah, and we're going to become one. We're going to start a medical school. So they're starting a medical school. And their idea, their long-term strategy for growth, is to make that medical school kind of a hub that will attract top talent. And then that could spread to other departments, kind of a trickle-down approach. And I was thinking about the fact that It seems to me that if we want to do what I think, I fully agree with your point about funding, a combination of funding individuals with institutions, kind of like what the Higher Education Support Program used to do at OSF and still may do at OSF, that's a very powerful thing. And if we identify the regional centers where these places are developing, those would be places we could strategically invest funds in individuals where there would also be a very clear institutional effect, which would allow us to, even though I'd like to get away from this kind of measurement and evaluation for immediate success, you know, we would be able to say, look, this has developed. Our scholarships have funded individuals who've gone back, formed institutions, which are long-lasting entities that are going to be having an effect long-term. And we've helped create these centers. And one of the things that's nice about it is that you would have, I believe, locals would be deciding where those centers of excellence would be. It wouldn't be a bunch of people from the U.S. coming in and saying, you should do X. Like you said, I like cats. Oh, I like cats too. We all like cats. You would avoid that conversation if people were saying, this is what we've decided we're going to focus on. We see that there's an alignment with things that we're interested in as donors. And then we combine individual scholarship support that actually is at the same time building individuals, but also building a larger institution that has lasting effects. And you could follow the effect over time with the branching tree model. You fund one person who founds a center. That center gets strong. Other people study at that center. They become professors who have effects here. And you could almost kind of do it like a tracing. And then we would be able to have something that would be a little more rigorous for the people who are demanding evaluation.
Okay. Lots to think about and move on with, but I would just like to take now an opportunity to thank Eric in the back, Zoe in the back, thank you, and our panel.